Government Committee, and we are going to begin with a hearing and work session on House Concurrent Resolution Number 4. I'm going to invite Representative Alan Brown to come up and tell us about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Alan Brown from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast, and I'm here today to testify on the Wolf Recovery Plan.
Oh, good.
Already.
In an empty house. Empty room.
Fluoride involved.
Yeah, then failing that, we'll talk about House Bill 2045, dealing with fluoride. Thank you again, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come here, and I very much appreciate the you hearing House Concurrent Resolution Number 4, recognizing the City of Toledo and their celebration of their 100th anniversary. And as we discussed before the meeting started, there must have been something in the water beside fluoride in 1905, because there is a whole slug of towns in Oregon that are celebrating their 100th year of incorporation. And the City of Toledo was originally founded back, you have before you the testimony that was sent over to me by Mayor Sharon Brandstetter of Toledo, so I won't go through and read the whole story. I'll summarize a little. The City of Toledo was originally founded and established by John Graham and Willie Mackey. They were two gentlemen, one from Canada and the other from Toledo, Ohio, so that explains how Toledo got its name. They established a post office there on July 14th of following the Rogue Valley Indian Wars, a very, very large Indian reservation was established on the Oregon coast that ran all the way from up in Yamhill County, clear down to almost Coos County and Coos Bay on the southern part of the coast. And in 1866, the federal government opened up part of that Indian reservation for settlement, and that's when Mr. Graham and Mr. Mackey filed a land claim on the confluence of Depot Slough and the Quinna River. Toledo is probably noted mostly for its wood products industry. The first mill was established there by soldiers from Indian reservation base up at Salats, and they built a sawmill about 3 miles up Depot Slough in Toledo. During the World War I, the U.S. government had need for a strong, lightweight material to build airplanes, and spruce filled up bill the best of many wood products. And so the Signal Corps came to Toledo and built the largest spruce mill in the world at that time. It actually, and also a railroad system that ran through virtually throughout Lincoln County to bring the logs there. They went clear down as far south as Yawhats and up as far as north as Otter Crest. In fact, my house is a portion of it sitting on one of the old railroad beds as they came up off of Quinna Bay and headed north up there. Anyway, they've had a typical, the way the government usually does things, they didn't hardly operate the mill at all. They spent all that money in those years building it up, and then the war was over. They did not need the material any longer, so they sold it out to C.D. Johnson Lumber Company, and they went on to not only a very large sawmill that operated very successfully in that area for a lot of years, utilizing the Douglas fir, the hemlock, and the spruce in that area. And my history serves me right, about 1959, they sold the C.D. Johnson sold their mill to Georgia Pacific, and Georgia Pacific operated the mill only a few years and shut it down and closed it out and built a very large paper plant on the site where C.D. Johnson was at that time. There was also in the Toledo area about that time, there was the Cascade sawmill, there was the Guy Robert sawmill that was built there in the 1920s. Georgia Pacific had a stud mill in the area. They had a plywood mill there in the area. There was a shingle mill there in the area. And with the event of things that took place in the early 80s and then the downturn in the economy through the 90s, we are now down to one Georgia Pacific paper mill left in that area. Over 1,000 people have left Toledo and the employment in Toledo from the loss of those sawmills. But the community is a very vibrant and community, and the people there take a great deal of pride in their community, and they've really done a lot of things in the last few years to spruce it up and make it look great. They have some very strong leadership with their mayor, Sharon Brandstetter, there. And it's a community that it's very obvious that these people are proud of. And I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about Toledo, and they might very much appreciate this consideration. Answer any questions?
You have an amendment?
I have an amendment. The dash ones, typical of the way I was in high school and our history in school, I got my figures screwed up on the bill. And so we have to, on line two, we have the dash ones on line two of the resolution that we delete 1865 and insert 1866. And on line three, on line 17, after biggest, we insert spruce. Get a wood product in there. Thank you.
Well, I have to tell you, Representative Brown, that as a teenager, my father was involved in the wood products industry, and the only veneer plant I ever visited was over there at Toledo. It was pretty impressive to see how they made plywood in those days and the big equipment. I still remember going to that plant. Nice community. I'd entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 4 be amended with the dash 1 amendments.
Representative Sumner moves the dash 1 amendments. Any objection? So moved.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 4 to the floor with a be adopted as amended recommendation.
Representative Sumner moves to the House Concurrent Resolution Number 4 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any objection? So moved.
Thank you.
Representative Brown will be anxious to hear about it more on the floor.
Okay.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Representative Brown.
Do I need to close this now?
You need to close that one.
I'm closing the work session on House Concurrent Resolution Number 4. I think I like to pound that thing.
Do it well.
Okay. We will, at this time, open a public hearing on House Bill 2118. And Kara, would you like to describe it for us, please?
I'd be delighted. House Bill 2118 provides for permanent public access to State of Oregon publications, regardless of whether they are printed or simply posted on an agency's website. This creates a digital state document repository built on the existing investment in hardware and software that the state has made for its e-government program. Causes the state library to create a catalog records for all state documents printed or electronic and make the catalog available to all Oregon libraries. It also reduces the number of copies of printed documents that state agencies and the Legislative Assembly are required to provide to the state library.
Thank you. There are two gentlemen here, Jim Shepke and Mike Freeze. I'm going to ask you to come up together, if you don't mind. And Jim, if you would lead off, identify yourself and explain this to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Shepke. I'm the state librarian, the director of the state library, and I'd like to note that we too have a centennial this year. Founded in 1905, it was a very good year, a lot of towns, and actually the Klamath County Library is another library that was founded 100 years ago, so I wanted to note that for the record. I'm pleased to be here today to testify on House Bill 2118. This bill was introduced by Governor Kulongoski at the request of the State Library Board. Howard Levine is our policy analyst from the governor's office. He couldn't be here today, but he did want me to tell you that the governor strongly supports this bill and believes that it's consistent with the governor's core principle that government should be stable, responsive, accountable, transparent, and consumer-friendly. And he also believes that that the governor feels this will make the state library and libraries more cost-effective in the state, which is very important. Let me summarize for you what this bill would do. It basically does two things. As your administrator noted, it creates a digital state documents repository that we've never had before. And I should explain that state documents are all the publications of state agencies and the legislature, reports, annual reports, interim reports, studies, consultant studies, anything that's printed for public distribution to inform the public about the work of state agencies is a state document. This is in distinction to a state record, which is what the archives deals with, the state archives. But the state library deals with state documents, and we've done that for 100 years. We've made it our mission to have all the state publications be in one place at the state library. But this bill would create a digital repository. Our entire program has always been based on print, and the statutes reflect that. But this bill would move us into a digital documents program. It would also reduce the number of libraries in the state that get state documents, because the bill would reduce the number of documents that are required to be deposited with us from 15 and in some cases 30 down to 10. And the thinking on this was, if we're going to create a digital repository that has all the documents, there's not as great a need to have as many libraries getting the documents that are printed. So that's the rationale behind that. Now, why do we need this? The reason we need this is that increasingly state documents are no longer being printed. And I brought with me today this stack of state documents that used to be printed and are no longer being printed. They are being posted on agency websites for downloading or printing by the user, but they are not being printed. And when they're not being printed, we're not getting 15 or 30 copies. And the risk is that when they're not being printed and only being posted to an agency website, that they could disappear. And the historical mission of the state library to have all of the publications of state government is highly compromised in that situation. And we've identified about 70 documents that used to be printed, many on an annual basis, that are no longer being printed. So that is the need. It's the need to continue to preserve the history of the state of Oregon, and that's why we need this digital repository. What is the fiscal impact of this bill? The fiscal impact comes from reducing the requirement of agencies to deposit documents from 15 to 30 down to 10. And that would save, we estimate, about $11,700 a biennium to the agencies. The bill also eliminates a statutory requirement that the Legislative Assembly deposit copies of measures, calendars, and interim reports. It actually puts the requirement for interim reports back in the law, so we will continue to get those under this law. But the requirement for measures and calendars, because those are already widely available on the internet, is taken out of the law. And that would save, we estimate, about $22,000 a biennium. There's also a requirement now in the law that the state printing division make digital copies of state documents that they handle. This was put in as sort of an interim measure a few sessions ago to try to begin to deal with this problem. If we can create a digital repository, they won't need to burn CDs, which is essentially what they're doing right now anymore. We're sort of modernizing that process, and that would save about $1,700. So the total estimated fiscal impact is a savings of $35,400 per biennium by our estimate. We don't see a fiscal impact to create the digital repository. And the reason we don't see a fiscal impact for that is that the state has already invested in our e-government program in hardware and software that we think will do the job, and Mike Fries can testify about that in a minute. So how will this work? How will this digital depository be created? Under the e-government program, agencies are already using a common software program, which is called the Content Management System, and they are already required to put what are called meta tags on all their documents as they post them to their websites. And what our plan is to have a meta tag that automatically makes the document, when it's published to an agency website, goes straight into our repository. So it will be highly automated. You know, it's not going to be the case that an agency will have to email us, you know, copies of documents, and we'll have to have, you know, staff opening up emails. And it you know, our plan is that this thing will just work very smoothly and in a highly automated way. These documents will just flow into the repository. When we get the documents, we're going to create library catalog records for each document, which is something we're already doing. So this isn't anything new. And those catalog records can be put out and be added to library catalogs in all the libraries in the state that want to add them to their catalogs. And that way, when someone in Malala goes to their public library, they can search for a document in the Malala Library catalog. If they find it, there'll be a link that will link them to our repository and bring up a full text file of the document, and they can print it out right there at the Malala Library. Or they can do that from home, because most libraries nowadays allow you to access their catalog from home. So we think this will actually create better access to state information than the old print-based system that we've had for 100 years. So in summary, we're trying to solve this problem that is a serious problem of disappearing documents. That could easily happen in the future if we don't amend our statute. And at the same time, we're trying to create a new system and do that in a very cost-effective way. We've worked on this problem for about 2 years, and we've had many meetings with Mike Fries and his staff in the in DAS IRMD. We've brought in the state archivist to consult with this because he has some special knowledge in this area. We think we have a good plan, a cost-effective plan that'll solve the problem, and we would appreciate your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to let Mr. Fries speak, and then I have questions, and I'll entertain further questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries. I'm the Deputy State Chief Information Officer. Also happen to be the state printer, which, curiously enough, is a constitutional office, but that's a subject for another day. What I'm here today to talk with you about is the digital document repository that Jim Shepke outlined for you. And what we're doing is leveraging an investment that's already been made here in the e-government, what we call the e-government platform, one component of which is a content management solution. The problem that content management attempts to solve is how you manage hundreds of thousands of digital documents. And if you go back to the mid-90s, when state governments and the private sector of the world was beginning to get documents online and build websites and so on, that was all done pretty much manually. and people would manually code what's called hypertext markup language documents and post them to a website. And that works pretty well when you have the number of documents that you can count on both hands, let's say. But once you get a certain number of documents, it becomes fundamentally unmanageable. And so what happened over time was a lot of the content would age and would no longer be accurate or pertinent. It would become obsolete. But because folks didn't know it was out there, that those documents could still be found and accessed and downloaded. The other thing that was happening during that period of time from the mid-90s to today, and this has been an emerging and growing problem over time, is documents that we call born digital documents, the kinds of documents that never show up on a piece of paper unless somebody chooses to print them out from their on their home PC on a printer locally. And those documents tend to get modified over time and or they become obsolete and the record of those documents disappears. That's a well-known international problem, frankly, and it certainly is a problem for state governments, and Jim touched on that as well. What content management allows us to do is agencies no longer have to know how to write that hypertext markup language code. They just go in and enter content in the same way that you would in a word processor, let's say, and they can format the content. And we're able also to impose some controls in terms of the look and feel, which is important in supporting concepts like the Brand Oregon Initiative. It's important in supporting concepts of making documents just look more uniform and official from a state government perspective. And what we're doing in this case is we're taking that same solution that all state agencies use, and we're making that available for this purpose, and that is to allow documents to be stored in a repository and to be quickly found through electronic search engines and brought online, right on through a web browser to be able to be accessed that way. As Jim mentioned, one of the things we're doing is using what's called meta tags. The way to think about that is it's like a digital card catalog, and one of the meta tags will allow these documents. It will basically state that the document is a public document, and we'll place it into this document repository then for people to be able to access. That will then preserve the record of that document so that it doesn't just disappear if it's one of the born digital documents that I talked about earlier. As Jim mentioned, there is no immediate incremental cost for this. If at some point down the road, several years down the road, if we literally have hundreds of thousands of documents in there, the only cost we would see would be additional storage, but that's the case with e-government as well. As the state puts more and more information online and moves more and more transactions online, you would see the infrastructure costs grow incrementally, but not to any large degree. And that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Freese. I'd like to, before me is a letter from the Oregon Library Association. Members of that group could not be here today, but they'd like for the record to have this statement. The Board of Directors of the Oregon Library Association has voted to support House Bill 2118. On their behalf, we urge the committee to give this bill a due pass recommendation. And they would appreciate this being read into the record. So done. I have a couple of questions, and then I'm sure others will come forward. You've got two issues here. Documents that traditionally, how big is that stack? We can't see it. Put it up on it. That traditionally have been housed, and are we losing them now? I mean, are they just not being published and not being stored? Are we literally losing documents?
Madam Chair, we don't know of any that we've lost yet, but we're very fearful that we will. This phenomenon is only a year or two old, and most of the documents that have been put up on websites are still there. But we fear that if nothing is done, that we will start to lose documents.
Are they able to put these documents on a website and not publish them because there's no statutory requirement that they be published, or is the statutory requirement that we've all been doing this e-commerce thing, and I feel like we're kind of caught in a loop of the technology here, because clearly these are public documents, access is critically important, and so if we go this route, do they have statutory authority not to publish in that format? And has that been given a couple sessions ago? What's the history here? Do you know?
Well, Madam Chair, the requirement is that if documents are printed, they must be deposited with the state library. And then there's this other requirement that the printing division create digital copies and give them back to the agencies. But we don't think either of those current statutes are adequate to address this problem.
And my next question is the access one. Clearly, in the past, you could call the state library and do a search for a document, and you would send them a printed copy. Was that the old method? And now they could do the same thing. You could ship it to them online. But would you also, if they were looking for a document and they didn't, would they have to go to a library? They would have to go to download. You couldn't download, print, and send it in the old printed sense.
Well, Madam Chair,
I know that the point is not to do that, but I'm concerned about people who don't have a computer.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I could, I wanted to note that attached to my testimony is the list of the libraries that are now getting the printed documents. And we're not proposing to eliminate that system of libraries that have printed documents. We're proposing to reduce that number, which to us seems reasonable if we're going to create a digital repository for all documents. To have fewer libraries with the printed copies makes sense. And I would call your attention to the list. It's in administrative rules, and it's adopted thereby by the State Library Board. And on the first page, you see the libraries that get all printed documents currently. And there's 11 libraries in state, plus the State Library, plus the Library of Congress. And then on the second page, on the back, are an additional 16 libraries that get the core, what we call the core documents. And there's about 47 of those, I believe. They're things like the Oregon Blue Book, the most basic state documents. And what the bill does is we would no longer have these core libraries, and we would need to reduce the list of what we call full depositories on the first page down to about 8, because we'd only be getting 10 copies of everything that is printed. So our plan would be 2 would be at the state library and 8 would be deposited. So this is a long-winded way of answering your question, Madam Chair, which is that there will continue to be many, many libraries throughout the state that do get the documents that are printed. And that's the best we can do, because we don't control, what gets printed and what doesn't get printed. But if it does get printed, there will still be many libraries where people that don't have computers or don't use the internet can go to get the ones that are printed.
Thank you, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shefke, thank you. I've had some email communications from librarians at Southern Oregon University and Oregon Institute of Technology who are extremely interested in remaining a core library. Has a decision been made? A full depository library. Has a decision been made as to which of these libraries would still be included?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, if this bill were to pass and be enacted, then there would be an administrative rulemaking process to revise this Division 70 rule that you have in front of you, and the State Library Board would hold public hearings, and we would listen to all the concerns of librarians, and then that decision would be made by the State Library Board. I can tell you that the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University is probably the best documents library in the state of Oregon.
They won
a national award as Federal Documents Depository Library of the Year last year. And so they are renowned for their documents collection. And so I would say the odds of them no longer being a full depository are nil.
Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
But irrelevant of that, they may not have the document in print, but they could access that document, download it, and print it for anyone's request. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, that is true. The intent here is to create a digital repository that will have every document available to every Oregonian. But I must say that there are times when being able to go to the stacks of a library and find, you know, a complete run of annual reports from the, you know, Oregon Department of Forestry. Let's say you're a forestry student and you're doing research. There's something to be said for going to the stacks and being able to browse, you know, several shelves worth of documents from the Department of Forestry, as opposed to going on your computer and kind of pulling them down one at a time. So
spoken like a true librarian.
So what we're attempting to do here is
ladder
is give everybody, you know, the best of both worlds, the best of the printed world, and but moving ahead to the digital world.
Follow up. Yes.
This will remain in a computer archive. Basically, that's what you're doing, and it will remain there. I mean, is it on form of disk? Is it in a computer bank? Is it in a hard? What is this being stored upon?
You wanna? Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, it's stored basically online in an array of hard disks, and then it's backed up periodically. We have a data archiving center, which you may know about in Burns, Oregon, where we back up data. And the agency that manages the data is really responsible for setting the archival schedule for that kind of stuff, and they will either leave it backed up on offline storage on tape, or they can back it off onto compact disks. So it depends on what the business requirements are of the organization. We would work with the state library to determine what the archival schedule for those is.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Question to either of you. I'm curious about the meta tag technology, not how it functions, mm-hmm. although I'm sure that's fascinating, but more so just sort of how widespread is this? In other words, is it sort of a variety of companies produce this, or is it one company, or just, do you see what I'm saying? In other words,
Madam Chair, Representative Galizio, meta tags are actually one of the standards that are agreed upon by international bodies that look at this. And the concept of meta tags are that you are able to tag documents with keywords, those kinds of things, what the function of the document might be, who the originator is. There are various attributes to meta tags, and those are embedded in this code that I talked about earlier called hypertext markup language. They're also used extensively in other kinds of digital documents, such as portable document format, the PDF files that Adobe Acrobat supports. So they're very standard and very common. They're not proprietary, okay. And a number of vendors incorporate them into their technologies.
Thank you.
Good question. I'm glad you could ask it.
Well, I could have asked it better, but
no. I had similar questions. Further questions from the committee? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We'll come back to this, and we may think of other questions. The new world of technology sort of is a head-scratcher sometimes. Thinking of libraries in a different way is sometimes not as easy as you think. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2118 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2125 and ask Kara to explain this one to us.
House Bill 2125 amends Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 657 regarding Indian tribes that pay unemployment insurance tax. It holds Indian tribes to the same standards applied to local governments that pay unemployment insurance taxes for extended benefits.
Thank you, Kara. I have Pat DeLava. Here. Delaval. Sorry. I apologize for that. You get to pronounce it correctly for the record.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pat Delaval.
Sorry, wasn't even close.
I'm the field operations manager for the Employment Department Tax Sector. And I'm here to introduce the Bill 2125, which, as you heard, will amend the Oregon law to treat taxpaying Indian tribes in the same manner as taxpaying governmental entities in charging of extended unemployment benefits. And I'd like to make a couple definitions before I get started. When we talk about extended benefits, we're talking about an actual federal program. It's not a generic term that refers to all types of extended benefits. Also, I'll be talking about the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, which is the fund that all employers, all taxpaying employers pay into, and that's the fund used to pay benefits. Also, when I talk about charging, we actually charge these individual accounts for the purpose of tax rates in future years. Okay. So when I say charging, that doesn't mean we send them a bill, and sometimes that's confusing. In 2001, the Federal Consolidated Appropriations Act required that all employees of Indian tribes be covered with unemployment insurance. The Oregon legislature passed House Bill 3596 to comply with that law. Under this law, Indian tribes were given the same option available to governmental entities, either to pay quarterly taxes or reimburse the unemployment trust fund for benefits paid to employees. When there were periods of high unemployment, an extension of benefits may be available to unemployed individuals. And generally, the state, through the trust fund, pays half of those benefits, and the federal government chips in for the other half. The federal government does not pay anything for governmental entities or Indian tribes, and the Indian tribes, therefore, Indian tribes that reimburse us pay 100%. But other governmental entities pay one half of their tax paying, pay half of the extended benefit. Due to an oversight during the development of House Bill 3596, there was no language put in there to charge Indian tribes for one half of extended benefit. This bill will correct that by inserting language that provides Indian tribes to pay one half of extended benefits. Without this, the UI Trust Fund pays all of it.
Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund.
That's correct.
Okay.
House Bill 2125 will amend Oregon Chapter 657 to add language, as I said, to treat taxpaying Indian tribes the same as other governmental entities when we're charging extended benefits to unemployment insurance tax accounts. And it will not affect any Indian tribes that are on the reimbursing side for benefits paid. Some of the other considerations, there are currently 28 taxpaying Indian tribes, 13 of these which were charged for extended benefits, had the law been changed in 2001. If this change had been in place, there would have been an additional $153,000 charged to the 13 Indian tribes. And again, that goes into the tax rate calculation. It's not charged directly to them. Of these 13, two of the tribes would have experienced a higher tax rate in 2005, one by 0.1% and one by 0.3%. No other accounts would have been affected. Extended benefits were available to qualified claimants in the period starting January 2002 and ending 2003. At this time, we don't anticipate that will be triggered again soon. The expected fiscal impact on the Employment Department is negligible, and there is no effect on our administrative costs. And a letter was sent out to the tribes in June of 2004 regarding this change, and to my knowledge, we've not received any concerns from them.
Have you received anything back from them? Have they commented on it?
There were, I believe the Warm Springs tribe did ask some questions, but they were not concerned with the effect it would have on taxes.
Okay.
And that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much for coming. We'll think about this, give the tribes another week to comment, and I think we have another testifier. Would you like to identify yourself?
Sure, Madam Chair. Member of the committee, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. And I was just having a quick conversation with Mr. Mason, who is the lobbyist for the Warm Springs Tribes. And he just wanted me to clarify that the 28, when we talk that there are 28 taxpaying tribes, it's actually entities. There are only 9 recognized tribes in the state of Oregon, and so it's 28 taxpaying entities of those tribes. That's just a clarification for the record.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for coming in. I will close this public hearing on House Bill 2125. Do we have anything else?
That's all we have today.
That's all we have for today. Interesting about libraries. Thank you very much. Adjourn this meeting of the House General Government Committee.